The whole class waited anxiously. Peavy Lawson tapped his fingers against his desktop. Emma Richards rocked back and forth. Lane Carlson giggled. Lucy Daniels wrapped a strand of her brown hair around her middle finger and whispered something to Irwin Leach. Never before had Mrs. Elnor Stilton treated us to anything. Probably some poison, I whispered to Emma, who sat across from me. Hush, she said. Toads and black cats. Troublemaker, she sneered. Toadstools, I said. Liar, she said. Poison pokeweed, I said. Shut up, she warned. Jack in the pulpit, Jack's little red berries. Zip it up, she threatened. Hemlock, I was saying, when the closet door creaked open. Class, Mrs. Stilton said. Everyone became quiet. Children, please close your eyes, she said. When I heard her switch off the lights, I opened my eyes. A constellation of flickering lights floated toward the front of the room. Fearful, I closed them again and was trying to figure out what I had just seen when I heard another clicking sound.
Now open your eyes, Mrs. Stilton said.
A huge rectangular cake with orange frosting and yellow-lit candles glowed on top of her desk. Neat little rows of candy corn decorated the sides.
All right, class, Mrs. Stilton said. There are 20 candles for 20 students. Each of you gets to blow one out.
We all stood up.
Trick or treat,
she asked as we filed toward her desk.
Treat,
I heard them say as they pressed forward.
A slice for each of you.
She put a piece of cake on Emma Richards' plate.
A big treat, they said at once. Thank you, they said and clapped loudly.
A trick, I said to myself. A cake laced with poison. But later on that afternoon, not one student suffered from a stomachache. Not even Peavy Lawson, who ate 3 slices. No one was sent home, and no one died. That October 31st, Mrs. Stilton had cast her spell. When class was over and we marched out to catch the bus, Emma Richards refused to walk with me. The minute I'd swallowed that slice of Halloween cake, I'd sealed my fate and turned into a liar before Emma Richards' eyes. On the bus ride home, I overheard her talking to Lucy Daniels.
Icy thinks she's so smart, she said, smarter than the rest of us, but Mrs. Stilton sees right through her. That's why Icy hates her.
By the time I got off the bus, she wasn't talking to me and had convinced everyone else not to talk to me either. The next day, even Peavy Lawson began ignoring me. No longer did he want me for a girlfriend. Whenever I walked down the hallway, my classmates would press their backs against the wall, melt into the plaster, and part like the Red Sea. When I mimicked Mrs. Stilton, they pretended not to notice. Like turning off a leaky faucet, they began to turn me off. Having lost my ability to astonish, I had lost my identity. At home, in the darkness of my bedroom, I hugged my shadow. Nobody will be your friend, Joel McCroy had once said, and now I knew he was right. Miss Emily was right, too. Cut off from the world, different and alone, we were just alike. Terrified, I withdrew even more, too proud to talk to my grandparents, too disconcerted by Miss Emily to talk to her. The first time I croaked at school, no one, except for Lane Carlson, heard me. It happened during recess. The girls were jumping rope. The boys were shooting hoops. Miss Palmer, my old third grade teacher, sat in a chair by the wide double doors and watched us. I was swinging in the rope swing that hung from the maple tree, throwing out my legs and pulling them in, whooshing forward and backward. While I swept back and forth, I looked at the fall foliage, the red, yellow, and crimson leaves, smelled the sweet, sharp odor of burning wood, and sang green sleeves. All the while, the sound of my voice soothed me. Lane Carlson sat on the other side of the maple tree, drawing pictures in the brown dirt with a stick. Twice I glanced down to see what he was drawing. Silly stick figures, I thought. But then, Lane Carlson had always been silly. A prissy sissy, he seemed like a caricature of what he thought a girl should be. Except that he had gotten it all wrong, and now it was too late. His father owned a gun shop and was the best shot in Crockett County. His younger brother was as tough and mean as Lane was girlish. Mabel pampered him too much, the town folk said. She wanted her first to be a girl.
Mothers didn't want their sons to play with him. Even girls found him too high-pitched and hysterical. He was a misfit long before I became one. A year ago, before all my own problems started, during one of our afternoon tea parties, Miss Emily had given me some advice. "Look at life from Lane's perspective," she had said. "He only wants to fit in. He just doesn't know how." At the time, I hadn't answered her. Swinging high above his head, catching a glimpse of his stick figures in the brown earth, I now felt ashamed. Then, as always, the bell rang. Lane Carlson abruptly stood up, cupped his hands around the corners of his mouth, and yelled something at me. I stretched out my legs and slammed my shoes like brakes into the dirt. Lane stepped forward, holding his index finger high in the air. I felt uneasy. "It's time to go in," I said. "What do you want?" He shook his finger at me. "Look," he shrieked. "What?" I said, coming closer. "Make it go away," he said. "Make what go away?" I asked, irritated. "This," he answered, and poked his finger into my face. "The wart," he giggled. "Frogs cause warts," he said, laughing hysterically, jabbing his finger at me. "Get away," I screamed, hitting his hand. "You're a frog," he said. "If you can cause warts, you can make them go away." He pushed his finger toward my mouth. "So bite it off," he demanded, thrusting the wart at me. I jerked back. "Eat it like you would a fly." I twisted my head. "You're a frog," he squealed. "You can do it." He screeched and triumphantly shoved his finger against my clamped lips. Ferociously, I bit down. Blood spurted forth. Astonished, he jerked back his hand and looked down at his bloody finger. "You bit me, you bit me," he moaned. "I'm sorry," I said, "but you made me mad." Shaking my head, I wiped the blood on my shirt sleeve. He lifted his hand and held up his hurt finger. A moment later, a smile slid across his face. "You did it," he said. "You made the wart disappear." Wide-eyed, I stared at him. "I'm a sissy. You're a frog witch." He came toward me with his arms outstretched. "Don't you see?" His voice was urgent. "Nobody likes us. Now we can be friends." He flung his bony arms around me. "What do you say?" he said, squeezing tightly. "Croak!" I bellowed at the top of my lungs. Startled, he flinched spasmodically and jumped backward. "Croak!" I repeated. With my eyes popped out and my head tossed back, I croaked loudly until the second bell rang. When we filed in from recess, I kept my head down. Lane Carlson tagged behind me, tugging at my shirt tail, giggling. Blood stained the front of my shirt and sleeves. Blood covered his hand. We looked as though we'd been fighting, but no one would believe that. Again, he pulled the bottom of my shirt. "What?" I hissed from the corner of my mouth. "What do you want?" "To be your friend," he whispered back. I turned around, looked at his pitiful eagerness, and, in an effort to hush him up, relented. "Okay," I said. Red blotches flushed over his cheeks. He tittered and giggled shrilly. Adamantly, I shot him a look and pressed my finger against my lips. He gulped once, then no more wild hyena laughs escaped from his mouth. "So Lane Carlson is going to be my friend, my only fourth grade friend," I thought wistfully. As we marched into the classroom, Mrs. Stilton, who stood by the door, stopped us. "What happened?" she said, grabbing our shirts, pulling us over. We both began at once. Then Lane, in a mannerly voice, said, "Icy was swinging too high and fell back, and I caught her." Proudly, he held up his finger. "Are you hurt?" she pointed at the blood. "We're fine," he said. "I cut my finger, that's all." He waved his finger from side to side. "Icy here stopped it from bleeding." "Really?" Mrs. Stilton said. "She wrapped her shirt tail around it," he explained. "Yes, ma'am," I said, lifting up my shirt. Mrs. Stilton clicked her tongue, mumbled something, then said, "Both of you go to the bathroom and wash up. I'll give you 5 minutes." Off we went down the hallway. As I rounded the corner, heading for girls, I saw that Lane was following me. "You're a boy," I said. "Use the other one." "Oh, yes," he said with a giggle, twirling around. "By the way," I said, tugging at his shirt. "Thanks." I opened the heavy bathroom door and, smiling broadly, went inside. A few days later, while we were discussing Costa Rica during our geography lesson, Mrs. Stilton glared at me, and immediately my anxiety began to rise. Thinking that she might detect trouble, I kept very still and made the most of my anonymity. While Sherman Murphy read a paragraph from the textbook, I tried to blend into the classroom. The minute he finished reading, Mrs. Stilton asked, "What is the capital of Costa Rica?" Emma Richards raised her hand.
"San Jose," she said in a tidy little voice, "and the capital of Guatemala is Guatemala City," she added, beaming.
We had studied Guatemala last week. "Very good," Mrs. Stilton said. "Class, what language do they speak in Costa Rica?" Emma Richards raised her hand again. I looked at her appeasing face, and a sliver of dislike cut through me. I inched my hand upward.
"Yes, Emma," Mrs. Stilton nodded and smiled at her.
"They speak Spanish in Costa Rica," Emma said.
"Excellent," Mrs. Stilton praised.
Red-faced, I shot my hand up.
"Yes," Mrs. Stilton said. "Hablan Español en Costa Rica," I said, remember what Miss Emily had taught me.
Mrs. Stilton squinted at me, tilted her head, and announced,
"Listen up, class."
A beginning of a smile flickered over my mouth.
"I see Sparks wants to show off," she sneered.
Flushing, I fiercely bit my bottom lip and knotted my hands together.
"Icy was too young when she learned Spanish," Mrs. Stilton jeered. "That's why she gets confused and speaks improper English."
I caught my breath. Warm anger rushed through me.
"I might be from the hills," I said bravely, breathing in, "but I don't talk like it. Your speech marks you for life," I said. "If you don't speak good English, people will hold it against you and you won't get a chance to better yourself."
"Now where on earth did you hear that?" Mrs. Stilton asked. "Those aren't your words, Icy Sparks. Who taught them to you?"
"No one," I said. "I can come up with my own words. I don't need no one, I mean anyone, to teach them to me."
"You're lying, Icy Sparks," Mrs. Stilton said. "Remember what I said about lying?"
"I don't lie," I said, thrusting out my chin. Rage flamed over my cheeks.
"Oh, yes you do, little girl," Mrs. Stilton growled. "You're known for your lies."
"I am not," I said vehemently.
"What about calling me a woodpecker?" she said. "Telling poor Emma here that I'm so stingy, so mean, that God punished me and turned me into a woodpecker."
"That's the truth," I said defiantly. "I've seen you in the woods behind our house. I saw your pointed nose turn into a beak. I saw your squinty eyes become woodpecker eyes. You bored your way into our birch trees."
"Then why do I look like this?"
she said, holding out her dark blue skirt, swirling slowly around.
"Class, do I look like a woodpecker?"
"No," the class said.
"Emma, do I look like a woodpecker?"
Emma pointed at me and snickered.
"Peavy, do I look like a woodpecker?"
Peavy shook his head.
"Sherman, what do I look like?"
Mrs. Stilton asked.
"Like our teacher," he said. "Like Mrs. Stilton."
"Lucy,"
Mrs. Stilton said.
"You look like our teacher," she said.
Mrs. Stilton pushed on.
"What do I look like, Ronnie?"
"A purty teacher in a purty blue dress," Ronnie Halcombe answered.
"Lane?"
she asked, cupping a hand over her eyes and looking toward the back of the room.
"Lane Carlson, what do I look like?"
He wouldn't answer.
"Cat got your tongue?" she asked.
Lane nervously tapped his feet against the floor.
"Answer me, Lane Carlson, what do I look like?"
Her voice was sharp and furious. Abruptly, Lane stopped tapping his feet, leaned forward, and jumped up beside his desk.
"You look like a woodpecker," he said boldly. "A red-headed peckerwood."
"See," I said, standing up too. "I'm not a liar."
Mrs. Stilton threw the textbook on her desk.
"Sit down, you two," she warned through pressed lips. "I know troublemakers when I see them."
She jerked open her desk drawer and snatched up the ping-pong paddle.
"You're misfits," she said, stomping around her desk, thudding down the aisle. "You're weird," she said, waving the paddle in the air. "A sissy and a frog," she said, coming toward me. "A sissy and a frog," she repeated, banging the ping-pong paddle against my desktop. "A lying, pop-eyed frog," she sniped.
frog, she said, and smacked the paddle against my arm. Frog, she repeated, whacking me again. I tilted to the left, felt my legs crumbling beneath me, and was about to slump down when, out of nowhere like a whirlwind, the urge rushed through me. Bewildered, I grabbed the back of my seat, steadied myself, popped out my eyes, threw back my head, and bellowed, "Croak!" Hopping up and down on the tips of my toes, my desk knocking against the floor, I roared, "Croak! Croak!" Lane Carlson giggled and shrieked hysterically. "Croak!" I grunted again. "Shit! Piss on you!" I hollered. "You mean old bitch!" I yelled and pounded my feet. "Piss on you!" I shouted, violently jumping beside my desk. Mrs. Stilton looked wildly around her. "You're both crazy!" she screeched. "Crazy!" she screamed, then dropped the paddle and stomped out of the room. When she returned with Mr. Wooten, the principal, Lane Carlson was still shrieking and I was still cursing. "Piss on you!" I bellowed. "Piss on you!" "It's ungodly," Mrs. Stilton said, pointing at me, looking around at the others, who sat stunned and mute. Mr. Wooten shook his head, calmly strode over, put both of his hands on my shoulders, and in a firm voice said,
"I see. Hush now. Get a hold of yourself."
"Piss, piss," I said. Mr. Wooten put his fingers to his lips, turned toward Lane, and shushed him. Immediately, Lane quit shrieking.
"Now go sit down," he said quietly.
Lane did as he was told. With his left hand, Mr. Wooten motioned to the door.
"I'll handle this," he said gently, grabbing my hands, rubbing them with his square fingers, pulling me out into the hallway.
"Mean old bitch," I moaned, my voice growing weaker. "Shit, piss," I said softly, closing my eyes, hearing the door snap shut. "Shit," I groaned. "Piss, piss," I sputtered, like an engine giving out. "Pit, piss, piss," I stammered. "Pit," I began again. "Pit, pit," I stuttered until completely exhausted. I stopped and was quiet.
"Good girl," Mr. Wooten said, nodding. "That's a good girl."
Picking me up, he folded me in his arms and said,
"Icy, you need to rest. I'm going to take you home."
Before I knew it, with my head on a pillow and a cotton blanket over my legs, I was lying down in the back seat of Mr. Wooten's Buick. It was new and smelled like freshly cut cedar.
"I need to talk to your grandparents," he explained. "Have you told them about these spells you've been having?"
"No, sir," I said. "I told Miss Emily Tanner, but she said I shouldn't worry. They'd probably go away." He glanced at me in the rearview mirror.
"You have to tell your grandparents."
"I'm afraid to," I muttered. "I don't want to disappoint them."
"But you must," he said firmly.
"I know," I said in a weary voice.
"Rest now," he suggested.
"Yes, sir," I mumbled, tightly shutting my eyes, seeing only the white splotches of sunlight that flew against my eyelids. "I'm kind of tired," I said, and felt myself sinking. I longed to sleep and never wanted to pop, repeat, or curse again. I wanted to dream in a place where pasture roses bloomed and goodness thrived, but just as I was falling asleep, the Buick lurched to a stop. As I opened my eyelids, I saw through the window the oranges, yellers, and reds of fall, our white clabbered farmhouse with its red metal roof, and heard the whine of the front door and my grandmother's voice.
"What brings you out this way?"
she said as he opened the car door.
"I got a sick girl here," Mr. Wooten explained, "in the back seat."
"Oh, my grandmother said, scampering down the steps over the rough yard. When the rear door opened, I saw the worried look on her face.
"If you don't mind, please bring her inside,"
she said as he leaned over, slid his arms under me, and lifted me up.
"I'm going to fetch Virgil."
"Gosh darn," he said under his breath, rising too soon, banging his head against the doorframe. But Mitanny didn't notice.
"Put her on the sofa," she said, already scurrying away. "I'm going to the barn to get Virgil."
My head was resting in Mitanny's lap, and Patani was rubbing my feet. Mr. Wooten sat in my grandfather's easy chair, red and brown plaid with patches on both arms. Too tuckered out to tell my side of the story, I listened while Mr. Wooten spoke.
"I've never heard her talk this way before," he said. My grandmother shook her head.
Heavens no, she exclaimed.
She comes with me to town, my grandfather said, and spends time at Margaret's bakery, but she wouldn't hear nothing bad there. I've caught her at Harry's garage, no telling what Chigger and Frank talk about. Once I found her at the barber shop, a bunch of old codgers getting their whiskers shaved and their hair cut, cussing up a storm.
Well, this was foul language, Mr. Wooten said. No garden variety curse words.
Oh, my grandmother said, stroking my forehead. I don't understand. Icy's never talked that way.
Never a problem, my grandfather said. With her hand beneath my neck, Mittanny raised my head, bent over to look into my eyes and asked,
Sugar, why?
I fluttered my eyelids. My voice broke.
I don't know, I said weakly. The bad words just take over. Even when I try to stop myself, I can't.
Mr. Wooten rose.
Isa needs to rest, he said, putting an arm around my grandmother. She needs to stay home tomorrow and think about what she's done. When she comes back to school, I know she'll be herself again.
At that moment, my face crinkled up and I began to cry. Like a waterfall, the tears washed down my cheeks. When Principal Wooten left, I retreated to the safety of my attic room, where on notebook paper I composed a letter to Miss Emily. Dear Miss Emily, how are you doing? I know it's a busy time for you at the store, but I miss you. Since last I saw you, only bad things have happened. Remember when I told you about the urges? Well, I've done all of them in front of my classmates, even some I didn't know about. Now, they all hate me, especially Mrs. Stilton. Miss Emily, I sure do want to see you. I feel so alone. Please come see me soon. Love, your friend, Icy Gal. I folded the letter into thirds, the way Miss Emily had taught me, and sealed it in an envelope. Next, I addressed the envelope and put it on my nightstand. Tomorrow, I would ask Patani to take it with him. He was going into ginseng and could, I thought, drop it by Miss Emily's house. I rolled back my quilt and eased into bed. I desperately needed someone to talk to. Without Miss Emily, my anonymity was complete. Closing my eyes, I felt the darkness, like loneliness, envelop me. Fitfully, I slipped into sleep. The following morning upon awakening, I stretched and yawned. Nebulous time, those moments between sleeping and waking, engulfed me. And for a split second, I thought that my dream was true, that I had been born again as graceful as a gazelle. But then the second passed, and I was Icy Sparks, trapped in reality, a time which would last forever. Hurriedly, I put on jeans and a red striped shirt, raced down the stairs, and stopped my grandfather at the door. Patani, I said, tugging on his sleeve, please take this. It's for Miss Emily. Nodding and mumbling, he slipped the letter into his shirt pocket and shut the door behind him. I crossed my fingers, closed my eyes, and imagined a big hook plunging into the endlessness of time's straight line and jerking it up. With one humongous tug, present time would be altered, and another, better time would be born. Throughout the weekend, I marked time waiting for Miss Emily's visit. When she didn't come, I invented excuses for her. Naturally, she'd be busy raising money for the volunteer fire department and picking out books for the library to buy. And even though she didn't go on dates and wasn't invited to social events like baby showers and weddings, she was always on some committee or other, running the show, acting official. As always, fall was a busy season at Tanner's Feed Supply. The farmers stocked up for the winter ahead. Johnny Cake would be tending his family's farm. All the work in the store would be left for Miss Emily to do. Of course, before the first frost, when the ragweed flourished, she always felt poorly. The rims of her eyes turned red, her nose watered constantly, her head ached. Often she was too tired to do anything after work. Still, though, on Sunday morning, I clung to the hope that maybe she'd visit. When she didn't show at supper time, I felt more alone than ever. Patani, did you take my letter to Miss Emily? I asked, spooning some corn pudding into my mouth. Without looking up, he just nodded. Throughout the rest of the meal, I caught him studying me. In response, I averted my eyes, avoiding the displeasure I thought I saw on his face. I didn't want to see how much I had let him down, for it seemed that I had disappointed everyone, including Miss Emily, and it was only right that now I should pay for it.
This will be your new classroom, Mr. Wooten said as he led me to a small supply room adjacent to Nurse Coy's infirmary.
He unlocked the door, eased it open with his foot, and flipped a switch. The room lit up. Against the walls on three sides were bookcases, cluttered with materials. Chalk, erasers, paper clips, construction paper of all colors, staplers, tape, tin coffee cans filled with scissors, folders, boxes of pencils, stencils, clear glass bottles of glue, rulers, puzzles, books, bandages, gauze, and bottles of disinfectant. Mr. Wooten pointed at a desk.
See, we brought your desk inside and cleaned off a shelf for your books. Mrs. Patterson from fifth grade will be your teacher. She'll spend the lunch hour with you.
I'll be by myself? I asked.
Mr. Wooten laughed and lightly squeezed my elbow. Nurse Coy is next door. He knocked on the wall. I'm a few yards away.
I nodded.
You need some time to yourself, he said, to think. It's only for a few weeks just to see how you do, I see. Then you'll go back to Mrs. Stilton's class.
I shrugged.
Really, I see, it's not so bad. Look at the books we got you.
He walked over to his shelf and motioned for me to follow. My textbooks and 12 others lined the shelf. At home, 15 books rested in my small blue bookcase with its four sagging shelves. At Christmas, on Valentine's Day, or on my birthday, Miss Emily would bring me a book. I hadn't read them all because some, as Miss Emily said, were beyond my years, but I'd get to them eventually, she always insisted. Now I had 12 new books to choose from, 12 more books to eventually get to. Mr. Wooten touched each book and read the title.
Little Women, Little Men, and Spinning Wheel Stories by Louisa May Alcott, he said. The Wonderful Wizard of Oz by Lyman Frank Baum. Cabbages and Kings by O. Henry. The Call of the Wild and White Fang by Jack London.
He stopped and took a breath.
Anne of Green Gables, Emily of New Moon, and Jack of Lantern Hill, all by Lucy Maud Montgomery. The Raven and Other Poems by Edgar Allan Poe. And finally, Tarzan of the Apes by Edgar Rice Burroughs. Well, I see, what do you think?
He asked, turning around to face me and plopping his square hands on my shoulders. They look hard, I said.
Mrs. Patterson will read the difficult ones to you, he said. Some of them, though, you can handle yourself.
It'll take a year to read them all, I said.
You don't have to read every one of them,
Mr. Wooten was laughing again.
Just read what you can, all right?
He patted my shoulders.
See that little blackboard in the corner?
He asked. I looked up at him and smiled.
You can write on it whenever you want.
Anything? I asked.
Whatever you want, he said. Your thoughts, your ideas, your dreams, anything.
I turned to face the window. Can I go outside? I asked.
He cleared his throat. After recess, when everybody else comes back, he said. You'll have the swings all to yourself.
He grinned broadly, his full lips stretched into half moons.
I see. We have to do this, understand?
Yes, sir, I said. I'd better behave or else.
Or else what?
His voice was concerned. His smile had disappeared. If I don't act right, I said, something bad is going to happen. He shook his head.
Not true, he said. Nothing bad is going to happen. Be a good girl and do what I say, then everything will be fine.
I walked over to the desk. The initials CW were carved into the upper right-hand corner. A blue ink stain zigzagged down the front. It was mine, all right. What do you want me to do? I asked.
Mr. Wooten retrieved a slip of paper from his coat pocket. Read chapters 8, 9, and 10 in your geography book and answer all the questions at the end of each chapter. Then grab a book from the shelf and start reading.
Anyone I want? I asked.
Sure, he said, smiling. Mrs. Patterson will be here before you know it. Oh, by the way,
he tapped his fingers against my desk.
Think hard on what you've done.
Yes, sir, I said.
And if you need anything, poke your head through the door and holler.
I grinned and opened my mouth to say more when he twisted the doorknob and strode through, leaving me all alone with my books. 2 hours had passed when I heard voices and laughter outside. Rising from my seat, I walked over to the window. In the distance, a group of boys were banging sticks against the white picket fence that encircled the fish pond. Then a voice called out, "Look, it's the big orange one! It's Jonah!" I squinted into the sunny, hazy day. Light glinted off the bars of the jungle gym. The swings whined. I pressed my nose against the window and stared at a boy, glowing in the sun in front of me. He pirouetted like a ballerina, twirled within my line of vision, then disappeared. Again, he circled nearby. I made a tight fist and rapped against the glass, but he ignored me. I tried to make him out through the sun's glare, but couldn't. Once more, I rapped against the window, but he continued to spin like a top. Then, frustrated, using both fists, I pounded the glass. "Hi there!" I yelled at the top of my lungs. On a dime, he came to a stop and turned toward my voice. "Icy?" he screamed in surprise. "Lane!" I yelled back. "Icy!" he repeated, running over to the window, tapping it wildly. "Lane!" I shouted. Then suddenly, we both began leaping up and down, our heads bobbing, our fingers traveling over the window. "But I thought you were at home," he said, all at once standing still. "No, I'm here," I answered. He cocked his head jauntily to one side. A clownish grin covered his face. "Where?" he asked. "In the supply room," I said. "By yourself?" he said. I nodded. His fingers sashayed over the glass. "Oh, we're going to have so much fun," he squealed. "How's that?" I asked. "I'm not allowed to play with any of you." "At recess," he said. "We'll talk right here, right now, right through this window." "You think?" I asked. "Oh, it'll be fun," he added. "The two of us inventing new ways to play. The two of us against the world." "The two of us against a woodpecker," I said. "A red-headed peckerwood," he said loudly, just as the second bell rang. After my recess was over, I looked around my room. Bandages sat beside rulers. Staples and paper clips were scrambled together in the same box. Red sheets of construction paper were shuffled among sheets of blue. Bottles of glue tumbled over stencils. Crayons were scattered along each shelf. Carbon paper dirtied onion skin paper. Rolls of toilet paper were stacked against the wall. All of this clutter bothered me. Such visual disorder disturbed the silence in the room and upset my mind. My thoughts began to taunt me. Curses shrieked inside my head. Frantic, I slid to the floor and pressed my hands against my lips. Broken pieces of chalk rested beside whole sticks. Coloring books were piled with textbooks. Tightly, I closed my eyes and shoved a fist into my mouth. Angry thoughts pushed against my skull. Swear words filled my throat, and I was about to curse loudly when an idea burned through my brain and, like a swallow of whiskey, soothed me. "Bring order to the room, and you'll bring order to your mind." Quietly, I rose. From now on, red construction paper would be stacked beside boxes of red crayons. Red pencils would come next. Red with red, yellow with yellow. Red and yellow mixed produced orange. Orange would be third. Orange with orange. The disinfectant was orange, therefore I set it beside the orange crayons. Since the black stencils were trimmed in orange, I put them next to the disinfectant. The rolls of toilet paper and orange wrappings were lined up next to the stencils. Pencils with orange erasers were plunked into a peach-colored coffee cup because everyone knew that peach was just lukewarm orange. And so on, my logic unfolded until my supply room was in perfect order, until it resembled the root cellar back home, where the canned red beets sat next to the strawberry jam and the green beans rested beside the collard greens, where every jar was color-coordinated and the room was a palette of harmonious color. Stepping back and admiring my handiwork, I knew that I had hit upon the answer. I could organize my surroundings and also organize my mind. It was Saturday. As usual, I was running in the hills beyond our farm to spend my anger, and becoming tired, I decided to rest behind the black pine near Little Turtle Pond. I felt a slight tingle in my left foot. Not knowing if it was the start of a twitch or a muscle spasm, I stretched out on the ground and rolled my leg from side to side, pine needles crunching against my jeans. The pine trees against the cool November sky seemed orderly. Only a few leaves remained on the oak trees. The jimson weed, milkweed, and burdock were gone. Uncluttered, the landscape was tidy, appearing as if the flora had been penciled in. Rolling my head on my shoulders, I looked at the stripped field, unruffled as a sheet, and enjoyed a calm I hadn't felt in days. Nothing stirred. The water was smooth and tranquil. The rock eye and little turtle pond seemed to be looking at me. The trees were motionless. The animals were tucked away and quiet. Nature, I felt, had mastered her handiwork. A feeling of relief swept over me, and I was on the verge of leaning over and grabbing the tips of my toes when, out of nowhere, came the sound of footsteps. Quickly, I jumped up and hid behind the pine's thick trunk. In the distance, wearing a green patterned dress, Mamie Tillman was marching. Her body was much thinner. Her stride was measured and sure. Every few feet, she zigzagged abruptly, either left or right, all the while moving precisely, almost mechanically, like a soldier during a drill, following, I realized, the old path leading from her place to the pond. When she entered the woods, her movements became more trance-like, her face as emotionless as a mask. There was, I recognized, a uniformity to her, a symmetry in the way she blended into the background. Beautiful order, I thought, touching the pine's old, weathered bark, realizing that for the first time in a long while, my hands were twitch-free. But as Mamie drew closer, I saw her differently. Deep lines cut into the corners of her mouth, and her raw red skin was damp with sweat. Though I knew she was a young woman, 28, I'd heard Mitanni say, she'd aged 10 years since I last saw her. Sprinkles of gray ran through her dark black hair, unkempt and straggling down her back. And in her large dark eyes there was a sadness so deep, it seemed to eat its way through her. Strangely, she was cradling a burlap bag in her arms. Every so often, she rocked it to and fro. When she got to the water's edge, she extended her arms, leaned over, and gently placed the bag in the water. In the cool, eerie silence, it floated for a second, then, with a little sucking sound, slid under. A moment later, she held out her arms. For an instant, I feared that she was going to throw herself into the pond, too. But instead, with her arms outstretched, embracing the air like a lover, she fell gracefully to her knees. Leaning over, she gently kissed the water. For several minutes, with lowered head, she stared down. Then, as if something inside her were prying itself out, her lips suddenly twisted, and she moaned, a low, anguished cry, the purity of which seemed to transcend sound. Scrambling to her feet, she threw her arms across her chest and, bending over, began to run. She sprinted wildly, zigzagging through the trees, her hands still clutching her shoulders. Her warm boots tore through brambles. Her hair snagged on twigs. And like a madwoman, she faded up the hill. Trembling, I glanced around me. The woods were not the same. Order, it seemed, had dissolved, simply evaporated into the air like mist. The pine trees were gnarled, their limbs twisting upward, pointed accusingly at the sky. Even the stillness of Little Turtle Pond had changed. No longer serene, its quiet water had become frightening, smooth like a shroud, final as death. "Help me," I whispered, running toward the pond, my hands swishing through the cold water. But my fingers touched nothing. The burlap bag was gone. It had vanished into darkness.
"Icy,"
I heard Mr. Wooten say from the doorway. Startled, I turned around. Over the past week, I'd been nervous and afraid.
"What were you thinking about?"
"Nothing," I said, fearing that perhaps my voice carried and that earlier in the week he'd overheard me. Whenever Mrs. Patterson had come to see me, I'd been polite and attentive. And when alone, I'd tidied up my life. Yet during those moments when Nurse Coy had been out, I had not remained calm, but had changed instead into my former self and vented every one of my stored-up urges. My body had contorted into hideous shapes. Foul words had bombed from my mouth, and I had proceeded to tick, croak, and curse until all my demons were purged.
"Didn't seem like nothing to me,"
he said, coming inside and looking around.
"Something seems different."
He arched his eyebrows and looked puzzled.
The room has changed.
I stood very still. Sadly, it now seemed that my makeshift classroom could not really calm me. Somehow, the colors weren't right. Peach conflicted with orange. The forest green erasers didn't match the lime green rulers. One yellow was more mustard than the other. Mr. Wooten walked over to the shelves.
Why, you straightened up everything, he said.
Yes, sir, I replied, and I've been reading, too, I said. Those books by Louisa May Alcott. Did you know my mama's name was Louisa?
He nodded, a slight smile on his lips. Which one of hers do you like best? He asked.
Little Women is really good, I said. Plus Women and Wooten both start with W's.
What's that? He asked, squinting at me.
Women and Wooten, I explained. They both start with W's.
Oh, he murmured, stroking his forehead, walking back and forth in front of the shelves. You've been working really hard, he said, frowning. But I don't quite understand.
He stopped in front of the rolls of toilet paper and picked one up. I held my breath. Order's fragile, I thought.
But why is this next to the stencils? He asked.
I bit my bottom lip. Chaos was about to take over. With the toilet paper in his hand, he headed toward the far corner of the room.
We stack it here, he said, placing the roll on the floor.
No, I mumbled.
What did you say?
He asked me. No, I repeated loudly.
No what? He said, glancing up.
You're breaking the pattern, I said. It can't go there.
Slowly, he walked toward me. What pattern?
The oranges, I explained. They go together. He stared at the shelves.
Okay, I see, he laughed. But we can't have toilet paper next to stencils. It doesn't make sense.
I lunged past him. No, I yelled, racing toward the corner of the room. You can't, I snatched up the roll of toilet paper.
I see, honey, it's no big deal, Mr. Wooten said. Just leave it there.
No, I screamed. You're ruining everything.
I see, he said firmly. Put that down.
No, I bellowed, fiercely clutching the roll. I won't let you. Calmly, Mr. Wooten approached me.
I see, he reasoned. It doesn't matter.
No, I backed away, waving the roll above my head. You can't have it.
I don't want it, he said, reaching out. I just want you to put it down.
No! I lowered my arm and pressed the toilet paper against my stomach. Shit! Piss on you! I screamed, crouching down. Son of a bitch! It's mine!
Instantly, Mr. Wooten bent over and shoved his hands beneath my armpits. I see. Stand up this minute or else, he ordered.
Piss on you! Piss on you! Piss on you! I yelled, rolling myself into a tight ball, the toilet paper still jammed against my belly.
Get up this minute, Icy Sparks, he demanded.
Shit, shit, I said. You mean old son of a bitch?
That does it, red-faced Mr. Wooten jerked me upward.
What you gonna do? I shouted, stabbing with my elbows. Groaning, he let go of me and I broke away. You gonna make me pay? I screamed, racing toward the supply room door, gripping the toilet paper with both hands. You gonna make me pay? What you gonna do? I flung open the door and dashed out. What you gonna do?
Mr. Wooten chased after me. Sprinting down the hallway, I shoved open the double doors and pushed through.
Throw me in the fish pond! Drown me! I cried, running around the building. Throw me in! Drown me! I said, darting toward the fish pond, reaching the picket fence and scrambling over.
I see, don't!
Mr. Wooten yelled, but his words came too late. I had already jumped into the cold water, this black, wet universe which God, at Little Turtle Pond, had shown me. Bluegrass State Hospital, a residential facility on the outskirts of Lexington, was a five-hour drive from Poplar Holler. The minute I saw the guard shack and adults roaming the grounds like they were lost, I knew that my premonitions had come true. This would be the worst fate to befall me. The dormitory, where the children stayed, was called the Sunshine Building, appropriately named, given its yellow stucco walls and brown-tiled roof. L-shaped in one story, it seemed more modern than the other buildings. In fact, the Sunshine Building stood out like a new car among old, used ones. Located to the left of the administration building, it was surrounded by a chain-link fence. Two swing sets, three seesaws, and a sandbox were scattered about the front and side yards. According to Mr. Wooten, the Sunshine Building was something of an experiment. While the rest of Bluegrass State Hospital was run like a hospital, the Sunshine Building set apart with its own small staff, was supposed to be different.
It doesn't have as many doctors and nurses, Mr. Wooten had told my grandparents. Too much of that is bad for children, he had explained. The people who'll take care of Icy will act like family.
My grandparents had understood and liked this idea. It was one of the many reasons why they had even considered bringing me to this place. After all, not even the befuddled Dr. Stone had hesitated for a moment.
She must go to Lexington, he'd said.
As we walked up the sidewalk to the front door, I saw children of different ages playing. A boy with auburn curls and green eyes sat cross-legged beneath a huge oak tree. A notebook rested upon his outstretched knees. In his hand, he grasped a pencil, and with pursed lips and knotted eyebrows, he drew a picture. A large boy with a dark crew cut, a boulder-sized face, and a stony jaw marched from the swing set to the seesaw and back again. Over and over, he retraced his steps. A girl whose face I couldn't see was corkscrewed in a wheelchair near the sandbox. Her dull brown hair bristled out from her head like a mass of Brillo pads. Beneath a maple tree, to the left of the sandbox, was a young girl lying twisted upon a bright green mat. Although she was on her stomach, her limbs were taut and rigid. While her neck and arms jerked to the right, the rest of her body pulled to the left. Every so often, her arms would hit against each other, her legs would knock. Then she'd lift her head, spasmodically wrench it to one side, and grin deliriously, her dark black hair spiking from her head like needles. I shuddered just looking at her. Oh, Lordy, I thought, feeling more alone than ever, thinking that even among misfits I wouldn't fit in. Mitanni put her arms around me and squeezed. Mr. Wooten thumped down the suitcases he was carrying and pressed the buzzer beside the door. A young woman with soft blonde curls warmly greeted us.
You must be Icy, she said, smiling. We've been waiting for you.
Yes, ma'am, I muttered.
Mr. and Mrs. Bedloe?
She asked, nodding at Mitanni and Patani. Patani extended his arm and shook her hand.
We're Icy's grandparents, he said.
Before she could ask who the other gentleman was, Mr. Wooten stepped forward.
I'm Charles Wooten, the principal at Ginseng Elementary, Icy's school.
And I'm Maisie Hurley, the young woman said. I'll be taking care of Icy.
She winked at me and took my hand.
I bet we'll become really good friends.
Yes, ma'am, I muttered, stumbling through the huge front door. We walked down a black and white tiled corridor, so brightly lit that I squinted my eyes against the glare, passed by several office doors, and entered an enormous living room. An oversized bookcase stood just inside the entrance, to the left of the door. Green and yellow plaid sofas lined two adjoining walls. Cane-backed chairs circling a round wooden table stood catty-cornered from the sofas.
This is our day room, Maisie said. Right now, patients are napping in their rooms, or else they're playing outside, she went on. When the place is quiet, it's easier for a new person to settle in, don't you think?
All of us nodded. Maisie took a keychain out of her pocket, fingered through a tangle of keys, then popped one into the lock and twisted the doorknob. The door to room 13 swung open. Curtains, covered with nursery rhyme characters, hung from the windows. Old Mother Hubbard, Little Boy Blue, Little Bo Peep, and Jack and Jill danced in front of me. The walls were light blue, and a dark blue bedspread covered the mattress. A little pink dresser with an oval mirror was beside the bed, and a rocker painted red, white, and blue stood in the center of a fluffy blue rug.
How do you like it?
Maisie asked, looking at me. I felt the tick subsiding. It's nice, I said, relieved.
In a few weeks, we'll return, Patani said. They want you to get used to the place, so they got rules. We ain't permitted to telephone or come before then. In the meantime, you best be pretty and patient, and as dear as the day comes, we'll be back.
You know, Patani said, her voice cracking, we'll be thinking about you. Ain't a day will pass that we won't be missing you.
We want to kiss goodbye, my grandparents said. Patani opened her arms. Patani did the same. I looked at them, hesitated for a second, then reluctantly stood up. If I hug you, you'll leave, I said.
I say we gotta leave, Patani said. They won't let us stay.
But you'll visit me, won't you? I asked.
Ain't nobody gonna keep us away, Patani said. Now come over here.
He motioned me over.
I want to squeeze some love into you.
With a heavy heart and quivering lips, I went to him, wrapped my arms around his waist, and screwed my face against his stomach. The buttons on his shirt pressed into my forehead. Squeezing him tightly, I inhaled his earthy smell and whispered, "Patani, I love you."
"Me too," he said.
With both hands, Mitanni tapped her chest.
"What about me?"
she asked. Twisting round, I rose upward on my toes, forced my head between her breasts, and took in the warmth of her skin, the softness of her plump, compact body.
"My darling girl," she said, "you was the light of your sweet mama's life. You're the reason for ours."
I gulped down tears and was seconds away from pleading, "Please don't leave me here," when Mr. Wooten said,
"Icy's a tough little trooper. She'll get along just fine, won't you, Icy?"
I glanced at Mr. Wooten. Concern had darkened his face, and his eyes seemed to say, "Don't make this any harder on them." So without shedding a tear, I hugged my grandmother tightly and stepped away from her. Mr. Wooten brightened and sidled up beside me. Then he tapped his cheek, leaned over, and asked,
"How about a kiss, too?"
My lips brushed against his skin. I could feel the tears coming, so I closed my eyes and lowered my head. With my heart splintered into 1,000 pieces, I was mumbling, "Don't worry about me, none. I'll be fine. I'm okay. I'll see y'all real soon. Maybe next week. Don't you worry about..." I heard a car door slam. Startled, I raised my head. My eyelids jerked open. "Mitanni, Patani," I cried. "Mitanni, Patani," I yelled. Panicked, I ran to the door, flung it open, and dashed down the hallway. "Don't go, please don't leave me here," I begged, pressing my face against the pane of glass, catching one last glimpse of him. Huddled together in the back seat of Mr. Wooten's Buick, the two intertwined silhouettes slipped past the guard shack, glided through the iron gate, and faded into the distance. Soon they would blend into blue misted mountains and disappear. From the end of the hallway, a voice called out my name. Then a patter of heels clicked to a halt behind me. Immediately, I turned around and saw Maisie Hurley breathing rapidly with her hands on her hips.
"They left,"
I said, sniffling back tears.
"But they'll be back," she answered. "Now come along," she said, smiling. "I want you to meet someone special."
With my hand in hers, Maisie led me to the day room.
"This is Rose," she said, releasing my fingers, squatting beside the strange young woman I had seen earlier.
She was still lying on the same green mat and was just as twisted as before.
"Say hello," Maisie suggested, running her finger alongside the young girl's cheek.
"Hi, Rose," I said, attempting a smile. "Rose has cerebral palsy," Maisie explained.
"She was born like this. She can't talk, but I think she understands every word we say."
I looked closely at her. This time Rose was lying on her back, and I could see her coal black eyes as they darted back and forth.
"Hey, look, she smiled at me," I said, pointing at her thin-lipped mouth, the corners of which appeared to curl upward. "Of course she did," Maisie said. "She understands. I just know she does."
"Does it hurt?" I asked, scrutinizing her knotted body, which seemed always to fight against itself.
"I don't think so," Maisie said, "but who knows, really? She can't tell us how she feels."
"She must feel lonely," I said.
"Very, but she's such a joy."
Rose gurgled, and drool slid down the corners of her mouth.
"Oh, Rose," Maisie cooed, plucking a handkerchief from her pocket. "My sweet baby," she whispered, leaning over and wiping off the saliva. "You're such a dear heart."
She patted the spike-like strands of Rose's shorn black hair.
"Such a sweetie," she said.
Staring at those black bristles, that idiot smile, and that fresh spittle, I was filled with pity and revulsion. "I'm not like her," I thought. "I'm not one of them."
"No," I said, scuttling back. "I don't want to meet anyone."
And with these words, I turned and ran out the door, down the hallway toward my room.
"I thought you might like some supper," Maisie said, entering before I could answer. "Is it okay if I put the tray here?"
she asked, nodding at the nightstand. 2 hours had passed, and I was hungry, so I shrugged and she put down the tray.
"May I sit down?"
she asked. I shrugged again,
and she sat beside me on the edge of the bed.
I know you're scared, she said, looking down.
I shifted my weight to my left side, and the mattress spring squeaked beneath me, but I didn't say a word. In the space of 2 hours, I had already vomited forth every tick, jerk, and croak that had been rumbling inside me.
No one is going to hurt you, she said. We just want to help.
I lowered my head.
Every child here is different, she continued. No one is better than anyone else, do you understand?
I could feel my face turning red.
I understand why Rose frightened you. She looks strange, but after a while she'll grow on you, and you'll come to love her. Mark my words, you'll learn to love her as much as I do. I know you, icy gal.
My body jumped. The mattress groaned loudly.
Where'd you hear that? I asked.
What? She asked, crinkling her eyebrows.
Icy gal, I stuttered. Why, I just came up with it, she said spryly. Why, don't you like it?
I guess so, I said. Then, breathing in deeply, I regained my composure, smiling ever so slightly. Maisie stood up.
How about some food? She asked, pointing at the nightstand. You can eat in here tonight, but tomorrow you gotta eat with the others.
It was not until she slid the nightstand in front of me that I looked at the tray and saw the meal. A shriveled brown hot dog on a bun, a bag of peanuts, a thumb-sized dill pickle, a chocolate cupcake so dried out that the frosting had lost its gloss, and a small glass of milk. We walked into the day room.
Where is everybody? I asked, looking around. Resting in their rooms, Maisie explained.
Oh, I said, fingering the ends of my braids.
Why don't you visit Rose? Maisie suggested.
I shook my head.
Oh, no, I said. She's probably sleeping. Well, if I know Rose, Maisie said, she's lying in her bed with her eyes wide open, just waiting for someone to visit.
I don't know, I hedged. I'm kind of tired.
Go talk to her, Maisie insisted. She'd love to see you.
Maisie held out her hand.
Come with me, icy gal, she said, waggling her fingertips. I'll take you to her room.
The door to Rose's room was painted dark blue with the number 8 painted in red above the doorknob. Inside, Rose was dressed in a long green t-shirt and was lying on her back in a large white crib. As I drew near, I noticed that Maisie was right. Her eyes were wide open.
I'll come back in 10 minutes, Maisie said. That'll give you some time to get acquainted.
But, I stammered.
No buts, Maisie said. She doesn't bite.
And with these words, Maisie was gone. I sucked in air. It tickled my lips.
What are you thinking? I whispered, inching forward.
From 2 feet away, I tried to find an answer in Rose's face, but saw none.
Does it hurt? I asked, coming closer. Blink your eyes if it does.
Neither eyelid flickered.
Speak to me, I begged. Tell me something.
Rose shut both eyes and groaned loudly. I pushed myself against the wooden slats of her oversized crib, lifted up on my toes, my head above the railing, and asked,
What is it?
Rose groaned again. Her eyes snapped open.
I know it hurts.
I leaned over and rubbed the inside of her arm.
I wish I could make it go away.
My hand rested on her shoulder. Rose gurgled. Her eyes watered.
Don't be sad, I said, caressing her skin. I'm gonna be your new friend.
I felt the warm flush of embarrassment, cleared my throat, and chanced,
But only if you want me to.
Rose blinked once.
Does that mean you like me?
I asked. She blinked again.
You do, I said, even after the way I acted.
Rose blinked a third time and smiled broadly. Her front teeth, small white kernels of hominy, all of them the same size, gleamed.
You've got a nice face, I said eagerly, a sweet smile.
When I brushed my fingertips over her lips, she began to laugh.
Sometimes I do weird things. I was laughing with her. Sometimes I croak like a frog.
I stretched back my neck and croaked. She laughed even louder, so loud, in fact, that her body vibrated and shook the bed.
Sometimes I jerk and jerk and can't stop myself, no matter how hard I try.
I contorted my body and made it jerk to the left.
I acted so bad that Mr. Wooten, the principal of my school, asked my grandparents to bring me here. He's my friend, so I don't hold none of this against him.
I looked deep into her eyes.
I reckon I got a touch of pokeweed inside me, the poison parts, the roots and berries. People like Mr. Wooten don't have to worry about pokeweed. They're too good.
I licked my top lip.
But for the likes of me, it's different. This poison builds up, gets stronger and stronger, until it has to get out. If it don't, it'll eat me up. It'll eat away my good parts, the leaves and stems, and only the bad parts will be left. And I'll be just like Mamie Tillman. My spirit will up and disappear, and only the shell of me will be left behind. So I have to let this poison out, a jerk here, a croak there, a cuss word, a nasty thought. Do you understand?
Rose rolled her head from side to side, flickering her eyelids. All the while, drool dribbled from the corners of her mouth.
I thought maybe you might, I said. You see, we ain't so